as we explore the cosmos this morning. Feels like feels like we're either at at an aquarium or we're doing some sort of looking at the stars. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the roundtable. It's a delight to have you with us this morning. I'm Joe, and we have a great group this morning, and let me introduce them to you. Also, a reminder that you can be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org. That's all you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org. Let us begin by welcoming the hardest working man in broadcasting, Alan Chartok. Yeah. Hello, sir. How are you?
You ain't kidding. No, that's not true.
They're like, oh, Alan has an 8 o'clock, and then he's on at 9, and then he has an 11, and he has. And I was like, oh, do I get a chance to say hi at some point?
But I want you to know that I spoke to the great Laura Walker this morning for an hour. It was an hour interview for our Conversations program, and she's remarkable. I mean, just incredible. She ran WNYC in New York.
Yep.
And I have to say, Joe, your ears should have been burning because she said not once but several times how she loved the roundtable, she loved the panel, and she loves listening to WAMC. And I got to say, that was really music to my ears because she's the top of the profession, and it was really very nice to hear from her.
Very, very nice. Well, we wish her well, and she's doing a great job over there already. And
at Bennington College,
it's a hard gig. So good for her.
And not only should your ears have been read or ringing, but so should Judith Inks.
Oh, we love Judith.
She's on her faculty, and boy, does she have good things to say about Judith Inks.
Absolutely. Well, we're thrilled. I'm glad you I'm glad the timing worked, that you made the show. That's good. And
we got here.
Yeah, here we are. Chris Churchill is on the program. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. How you doing?
You know, I'm remarkably chipper and happy today. I don't know why, but I just came in a good mood, and I don't know.
You chose some great music.
Oh, that's good.
You chose some great music for being chipper.
I know. As I said, I felt like I was going to some sort of astronomy class, but that's fine. But how are you, Chris? Everything okay?
Yeah, doing good. Doing good.
I don't know if you'd convince a jury, but sure, we'll go with it. No, it's all right. Well, it'll become apparent
that music
later
definitely
on.
Rubbed off on Chris. Huh?
Yeah, you know what? Half the people it soothed, the other half it hypnotized. I tell you who did it, but I can't even pronounce the name. I think it's Redelius, and the album is Warlieb. Would that be? I don't know. It's Whreliebe. So make of that what you wish. The dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, is in the house. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Joe, I am also charged up today, even though you tried to throw some water on my get up and go with that music. 13 days to the election. I know we're going to talk about that. And I don't know if you noticed, but Spencer Davis passed away. And I just want to sort of recognize how amazing he was and his contribution to rock and folk. So my thoughts and prayers go out to the Davis family and thank him for everything he did.
Well, thank you, Bob. We also welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Good morning, everyone.
I know it wasn't that long you were on the show, but it seems like it's been a long time since you've been on the show. So I welcome you back, and I'm very glad that you're here. We've missed you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, let's get started and talk about what's going on in the world. If you dare. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and all we ask for you to do is keep them short and to the point, and we've been getting a lot of letters that have been going, Sarah wanted me to remind people, we've been getting letters that have been going a little bit long. And if you can keep them really short, that helps us because we can get to as many letters as possible. I don't think a day goes by that somebody doesn't chastise us for not getting to their letter. And I always say what I will say now, which is that we really do try to get to as many letters, but many letters are similar in nature. So we will pick one that is representative of the tone of others. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and you know what Ike said? A good old Ike, he said, there's nothing in the world that can't be put on a half a page of paper.
Okay, and that's Eisenhower.
Yes, not, Ike Eisenhower.
Yeah, not Ike Turner. Okay, good. All right, great.
No.
I trust one much more over the other, yeah.
And Joe, just to remind everybody, Griffin does not have an A or two S's in it either.
Well, thank you for the tip. We appreciate that. That's very, very nice of you. All right, let's go to the stories of the day. And there's a lot of places we could start today. I don't even quite know where to go. I'm most fascinated by the 60 Minutes story, but we should probably talk about the stimulus. Alan, do you have a choice?
Well, no. We could go with the stimulus first. We didn't do it yesterday, I don't think, but
no.
We should do it.
Well, it's fascinating because McConnell is Mitch McConnell is really the one that seems to be throwing cold water on this. If you remember at the town hall last week, last Thursday with Savannah Guthrie, the president said it was all Nancy Pelosi's fault. Nancy Pelosi won't agree to a deal. Nancy Pelosi is doing everything she can. She doesn't want to have a deal. She doesn't want to do anything. Well, Nancy Pelosi and Steve Mnuchin and Mark Meadows, they're all working, and they said they were making great progress. Now, Mitch McConnell, who of course heads the House, the Senate Republicans, is moving to head off a stimulus and says. And saying to his colleagues that he had advised the White House against striking a pre-election deal with Democrats to deliver pandemic aid, fearing political repercussions. So, God forbid anybody actually be helped. Mr. McConnell's remarks, confirmed by four Republicans familiar with them, threw cold water on Mr. Trump's increasingly urgent push to enact a new round of pandemic aid before Election Day. They came just as Ms. Pelosi offered an upbeat assessment of her negotiations with Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, telling Democrats that their latest conversation had yielded common ground as we move closer to an agreement. And you'll remember, of course, yesterday was the deadline, really, that Nancy Pelosi had set and said, you know, we have to come to some agreement by then. And she said it's still worth talking about because we now have this common ground. So what is Mitch McConnell up to, Alan?
Well, it's not what he's up to. It's up what the 20 senators in his conference are up to. And this is a real threat to his leadership. The fact is, 20 of them don't want it. Now, I saw a poll this morning that said an amazing 72%. I wish I could quote the source. I can. 72% of the American people want this relief package. 72%.
Yeah, I think it was a New York Times poll.
I'm sure it was. And thank you for that, Joe. And I have to say that the president of the United States reads those polls. Because it's been very interesting that he has been saying, I want even more than Pelosi wants now. And you have McConnell with his reticent conference, which is a real threat to his, because what does he do? If he took all the Democratic votes and the Republican votes, he'd pass it through. But McConnell doesn't like to do that. He doesn't like to give the Democrats the say in this, and so that's where he is, and he's in a real tough spot, which is okay with me.
Bob Griffin,
you know, Joe, it's McConnell sort of reminds me of a guy on Sunday morning who went on a bender on Saturday night, saying, "Oh, you know, please God, you know, let me die. I'll never drink again." In this case, though, it's about a spending bender and not necessarily alcohol. Let me throw some numbers at everybody. As of this morning, there was 929 deaths of American yesterday from COVID. The total death number is up over 220,000. There are more than 8.3 million total cases. We have McConnell and others in his party who are refusing to get the aid to the people that need it. This is blocking aid to state and local governments, to the medical community. Frankly, he's acting as if the tax money that should be coming back to us is his and not ours. It's also, I think, that this whole blocking of the stimulus package is linked with his desire to continue to push the Supreme Court appointment through and the concern that he may have that the stimulus package could take that off track. So I think there's a lot at play here. I also don't think this is going to play well for his senators that are up for re-election right now.
How so? What do you mean?
Because I think that you quoted the number 70% of Americans support
72.
This, and honestly, 72. I mean, Alan, people need this money so desperately. We're really starting to see the impact on people not being able to pay their mortgage and rent.
I hear you. That wasn't my question. My question was, you said that it wouldn't play well with some of the senators. It seems to me the senators have to see that same 72, and yet they're not doing what's right.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. I think you're absolutely correct, which tells me that there's another equation in McConnell's thinking about this whole thing.
Chris Churchill.
Well, in that town hall you referenced, Joe, the president also said that he thought that the Senate would come around if he and Pelosi reached a deal. And I do think that's probably true. I do think that if they came to an agreement, McConnell would find enough votes to get this thing passed. Like, I have trouble believing that they would block a package that, as you guys have said, is A, so popular, and B, would probably help the president's reelection chances, right? So, I'm not sure if I totally understand the Supreme Court point, Bob. I guess in a way that, but it seems like they can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? They can vote on both.
No, don't give them too much
credit.
Yeah,
I don't know. Seems like heavy lifting to me, but okay.
Maybe I'm being too optimistic. But,
Chris, if you look at the Senate schedule,
another number to consider is, what's that?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just, my only comment to that, Chris, is that the Senate schedule is so tight right now, there's not a lot of time published. That's
yeah,
where
yeah.
I think
you might be right about that. But the other number I'd throw at, to add to Bob's list is one that Governor Cuomo mentioned yesterday, which is that New York is facing a $59 billion budget gap. Mm-hmm. I know that we kind of get lost in the numbers sometimes, and sometimes it's hard to put those in context, but that's just a staggering number. I mean, that's a devastating number. And that results partly from New York's own kind of fiscal mismanagement. It's not entirely related to the coronavirus, but, it'll be dire times in New York if the state doesn't get some sort of federal help.
Jennifer Burns.
I think the thing I've been focusing a lot on is this holdup, the talk about the liability, concern. They're debating about the liability, right? And McConnell's really saying that he is unwilling. He doesn't want to hear anything unless it includes these stipulations about protecting employers and businesses from lawsuits or fallouts if they're not complying with whatever the state regulations are to prevent the spread of COVID.
Yeah.
And I think that's a very important piece to this conversation because it's so much about reopening and having everyone back out, which we all want to do, but we still have a debate going on whether you should wear masks or not, right? And so that part of it is very concerning for me because you're going to have more employees who want to get back to work. They need to. They have no way of paying bills, or some are unemployed. We see the unemployment rate rise. And then now it's, sending them out to herd immunity and without the medical protections in for testing or the stimulus money in there for testing and tracking. And this could lead to overwhelming the medical profession again. So that part right there is sticking with me a lot that he, and McConnell, of course, is trying to keep the Senate Republican. He's trying to keep his own seat, which we know has been controversial recently. And he definitely wants to push through Amy Coney Barrett. And that's what his priorities are. So if you don't eat, if you're getting evicted, it's all the Democrats' fault, and it's Pelosi, even though Trump is saying whatever Trump is saying today.
And I understand all of the points that have been made this morning and agree with most of them. My question, though, is that Mitch McConnell has been reluctant, even prior to the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, to get any package through. I mean, we've been talking about months and months of going through this, which I don't quite understand, Alan.
Well, I think, Joe, it all has to do with the fact that, McConnell has to keep his conference together. If you don't go any further than that, you don't have to, really, because he's got those people, for whatever their inexplicable reasons, and we've already talked about this, are so many of them for saying no to any help whatsoever. He knows his leadership is a function of those people holding up their hands and voting for him. He is, I've called him the turtle, not because of the way that he looks, but because of the way that he acts. You know, it's as if there is something surreal about his temperament, which is, I'm not really a human being. I'm just moving my head one way or the other, just like a turtle does.
But if the shell fits, yeah.
Right, Chris?
Hey, slow and steady wins the race, Alan. Sometimes, anyways.
Let's see, just about a minute before we have to go to a break. Audrey says, I love your show. Listen every morning. Thanks for your insights. I saw an opinion piece on CNN that hypothesizes that Trump will trade the peaceful transfer of power for immunity from prosecution after his term. Do you think the Biden-Harris DOJ will go for something like this to unite the country?
That's a great question, and I've been thinking about it a lot. And I think that the idea that, you know, here is the Biden presidency, and Biden is already saying we're going to put Republicans in the cabinet, and we're going to bring the nation together. Is this guy Biden going to want to go after Trump in the way he deserved to be gone after? That's the question.
Kathy writes, just this morning, I saw an initiative to inspire Americans who live abroad to vote. Folks, listen to your station from all over, as we've heard. Could you please plug votefromabroad.com? Well, you just did. Right. You just did, Kathy.
You did it.
Congratulations. We're going to take a break. We'll pause. Hold that thought, Bob. Write it down on a piece of paper. We'll come right back to you, I promise. We have to take a break. We'll go hear British people tell us the news, and when we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back. Title of this track is The Logie Carousel. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Jennifer Burns. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Let's see. Jim says, are Republicans playing a pre-election game with stimulus or realizing Trump will lose? And the game Republicans want to play is to be able to go back to anti-deficit stances when Biden wins.
Yes. Joe, that is exactly the point I was going to make before break. I actually do think this is McConnell's pivot away from Trump in setting up his caucus to be fiscally conservative so he can block Biden's efforts through control of funding.
Anybody else on that?
Sounds reasonable.
All right. Let's go to Evelyn. I'm wondering what has happened to our governor's request to discuss help for New York with Trump. What about New York's budget gap? Anyone know? Thanks for all you do.
Well, the governor has made it plain from day one that without the federal help, New York is in great trouble. But he will not acknowledge that there's a plan B. Well, there has to be a plan B because New York doesn't have a printing press, right, Chris? And we can't print money like the feds can. So therefore, either you get it or you got to start telling people, pull in whatever your belt.
I think he's talked a little bit about a plan B, right? I mean, he said that without the money, there will be tax hikes and there will be a lot of budget cuts and layoffs. I mean, I think that's plan B. What else can the state do?
There is nothing else they can do, and we know it. And they're already cutting everybody back temporarily 20%. We know that they're getting less money, that's the way it's going to be.
I think the governor's just praying that that Biden wins and Democrats take over the Senate. I mean, I think that's the actual plan B, and then the tax hikes and the budget cuts are plan C, maybe.
I'm sure you're right.
It seems to me, though, as we go through what is, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but as we go through this third surge, that by all accounts is going to be horrible. We don't even really know how to assess the damage here, do we? Of what we know what the economic ramifications are right now, as of right now, sort of. But what are they going to be in 3, 6, 9 months?
No, Joe, we don't.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that point, it is an excellent point. We're seeing a surge that you know, we're at the very beginning of what would be traditionally the flu season. And, you know, we all know that fall is here and winter's coming. And we do anticipate an increase just because everybody's inside. And it's bad right now. I mean, when you start to look at some of the numbers that were posted today, Wisconsin had, you know, almost 20,000 new cases yesterday. You know, the Dakotas had 5,000 new cases each. It's the numbers are frankly staggering. And all we hear is the president calling Fauci an idiot with no real plan.
I mean, we went from what, 20,000 cases, new cases, to 40,000, right?
No, 60,000.
In a week. In a week, yeah. And they're expecting some believe that number could double in the next week. I mean, that's staggering.
Yes, yeah, and the 14-day change is over 36%. And if you start to see that doubling, it's absolutely going to be crushing. The other point is that if you start to look at the hospital capacity, it is already tapped out in a lot of places. And the lagging indicator in all of this is going to be the death rates. But we are nowhere near out of this. And regardless of what happens in a couple of weeks, this is going to be with us.
So what about all those people who say they're going to vote for Trump no matter what he says no matter how much he lies? That's the thing that keeps making me put my hand up against my head, you know, whack. I can't get to it. I just can't.
Yeah, and if I could toss another number at everybody, because I thought this was interesting. You know, we talk about fairness and tax fairness and the need for services. I went online and sort of figured out that the per cost for COVID per dollar cost for a COVID test is about $119. So if you think about that, that means that Trump's taxes of $750 bought 6 test kits for the country. So everything, Alan, you just said is spot on. But think about that: 6 test kits from a reported multi-millionaire, not billionaire.
Jennifer Burns.
You know, it just brings me back to, you know, people are, many people, his base, and some people that are sort of moderates are still willing to look past Trump's race baiting and his name calling and his social media bullying and flat out sometimes lying and flip-flopping to retain the little bit of power they think they have.
Absolutely, and that, right.
You know, and that's really what's happening here. I mean, mm-hmm. People are going to continue to get sick from COVID, and the death toll, the death rate is going to be enormous. And it's not just that. It's also the anxiety and mental health issues that are rising mm-hmm. as people are thinking about being back inside, indoors. And no, everything's not shut down, but the world is much slower, right. And the virus is going to get worse. And you know, I'm appalled, I guess I would say, that some people would still continue to support him, but at the same time, if they are getting by, we're talking about his beliefs. If some people are getting by, they fear that they will lose out, and so they're going to double down on whatever he's promising. Mm. And that should scare people.
Well, it's just it's racism, yes?
Oh, it's racism. It's sexism. It's classism. It is. I mean, all of this is happening at the expense of the middle class and the lower class. And they're predominantly, you know, made up of people of color. You know, the COVID, the impact here, too, of the virus is overwhelmingly disproportionate on people of color. And that's
absolutely
going to continue.
Absolutely. We know that. But the question is, how come some of the people who were most, and this has always been the question, Jennifer, always been the question, how come so many of the people who are hit the worst by this, and I'm not talking about people of color, I'm talking about people who are white, frankly, how can it be that they stick with Trump no matter what? And I think you've given us a very good hint there.
Well, you know, it's polite racism. You know, many do not believe in this group. Some are just outright bigots. We're going to go with that's what it is, right? We cannot deny that. Trump may deny that there's white supremacy in America, but the rest of us recognize that it exists. But some are in their suburbs and they want them to stay the way that they want. And they believe that they're not racist, but they are supporting a systematic racism. They are protecting, you know, their zones, we'll say, at the expense of others. And it's going to also be at the expense of themselves, because these policies are going to then impact their homes, their health, especially if we see layoffs and we see more furloughs where their incomes are going to be hit, or, God forbid, they lose their health insurance.
Well,
right?
Joe,
so they're
you're
voting
our...
against their best interests.
Now, Joe, you're our poll expert, but the last time I was looking, suburban women were a big problem for Trump right now. In other words, those very women we're just hearing about are voting for Biden because they have a sense of what's right and wrong. The men, that's not so clear.
Well, and that's where the problem lies, right? We're looking at older men who are in the suburbs as well. It's not just the wives, or it's not just the women there. We're also looking at the pocket of older men, white men in particular, who say they disagree with how Trump handles things, but they like his policies. So they'll
But the women were with him the last time, and there has been a real loss there for Trump. I think that's what's got them scared. It's not that
Right, Alan.
I hope so, but they're also I hope so, but I also know the more he trolls and pushes the radical left and the Black Lives Matters as an extremist group and all those things, that scares people, too, into saying, well, it's only four more years and it'll be fine. And so
not yet. It hasn't happened. The polls, I mean, you're appropriately worried about that. But the polls are showing no movement whatsoever, you know, 9-10 points ahead for Biden.
Although we are seeing movement in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, which is worrying, right? For Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alan, the polls are tightening a little bit. I mean, the Real Clear Politics average, it's down to about 8 points for Biden. And, you know, and as Joe kind of suggested, it's not really the national poll that matters much. It's the state by state polls. And you can see a path to victory for Trump if you look at the state by state. I mean, a lot of the states, you know, it'll be Florida and Pennsylvania and maybe Michigan that really decide the election.
Joe, what are our polls?
You know, but to go back to
Go ahead.
Alan, what did you say? What was your question?
I was going to ask you to give us the latest on those state polls.
Well, in Michigan, he's up by 8. Pennsylvania up 6.2. Wisconsin 7, and Arizona 3. I think
that's all pretty substantial to me. I don't know about anybody else.
Well, but the fact that it was 7 points in Arizona, now it's 3. The fact that it was 10 points in Pennsylvania, now it's 6. That's where the concern comes.
The average I see is 3.7 for Pennsylvania. I mean, you can look at all sorts of different ways to, you know, slice and dice the number, Real Clear Politics is 3.7 in Pennsylvania and heading downward or getting tighter.
Which is why Obama's going to be there today, right?
What's
that?
Obama's going to be in Pennsylvania.
That's why Obama's going to go to Philadelphia today. Yeah. And I don't know if you noticed, but Melania had to cancel a rally because she's still under the having the effects of COVID. And
she's coughing.
Obviously, you know. I hope she's well, but I mean, it also shows you how insidious COVID is. Sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I've tried to make this point like 8 times. I might as well just give up.
No, make the point. Make the point.
Yes, did it again. If you if you look at the polling, it is suburban women where he has seen a big drop off, but also among elderly voters. And, you know, I think some of the, you know, that has to be tied to the coronavirus. I would think people who are the most vulnerable to the virus, feeling that the president didn't take the thing seriously enough. I mean, that was a solid Trump. Voters over 65 were a solid Trump group in the previous election, and he's really taken a hit there.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will continue, and we'll talk to our wonderful panel, Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Jennifer Burns. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Yeah, looking at the Real Clear Politics polls, Pennsylvania, Biden is up by 3.7. Florida, Biden is up by 1.6. North Carolina, 2.3. For some reason, I just hit something and it moved. Oh, North Carolina up by 2.3. Georgia up by 1. Ohio, Trump is up by 0.2. Those are really close numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And they're closer than, generally speaking, they're closer than they were 4 years ago. I mean, Hillary was up by a little bit more in most of those states.
So what does that mean, do you think, for the next 2 weeks, Alan, of well, week and a half, that this kind of stuff to do?
Well, as you know, Joe, some countries, England and others, Great Britain, have been run campaigns in 2 weeks. So 2 weeks can make a huge difference. Obama, if Obama does his thing, it could be very helpful. Particularly turning out people of color, because let's face it, that is going to be a huge difference in whether some of these very marginal states are won or lost. Very important.
Let's go.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's going to be a turnout election, right? It's going to be whoever gets their people out the most in these particular states will win.
Also, about the polling, just one quick thing, Bob. One of the things that everyone who's doing the polling is telling us is that don't forget that because of the record number of people who have voted early, that many of these polls are exit polls as opposed to who are you going to vote for, which is interesting as well. Go ahead, Bob.
But also it makes it even more insidious, the GOP's efforts at voter suppression. You know, when you think about how difficult they've made it for people to vote in key places, you know, thinking about Texas and Florida and Georgia, and this is where the evil fruits of the seeds that they planted are. They're hoping they're going to grow. I'm a little bit suspect of the polls, both because I have PTSD from 2016, but I also don't know if this enthusiasm is because it is with new voters, or it's because of COVID, or how to incorporate some of those variables into this.
Well, we do see a lot of new voters.
I hope so, Alan. That's the key. No, you hit it right on the head. The new voters could absolutely change things, even in places like South Carolina.
Mm.
That's why those long lines are so impressive to me. You see a lot of young people online, and we pretty well know from the interstitial polling and the rest of it who they are and what they want. But yes, you're absolutely right about one thing, and that is 1%. By, you know, doing the kinds of stuff they're doing, by suppressing the vote and the rest of it, 1% could win or lose this election.
We got this from Anthony. It says, Biden keeps getting asked about court packing. Isn't this really a function of Congress?
Well, you ever hear of leadership? You know, a president says, this is what I want, especially if he's got the Senate and the House, he'll get what he wants, in my opinion. Now, Roosevelt didn't. So we'll see.
Sam writes, it's,
yeah, I mean, it
go ahead,
Congress would have to approve it, but they'll do so with the president's okay, presumably. He should answer that question, by the way.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, he said he will.
No, did Chris have more?
Well, when? The election, people are voting right now. I mean, he should answer it, and reporters should keep pressing him until he does. Yeah.
Well, I don't know that, as I've often said, and I'm quoting myself now, should Schmud, he's thinking politically. That's what he's doing. He knows if he answers the question, at least now, if he answers the question, he's going to lose somebody on either side. So don't answer the question. That's what he's doing. I approve.
You know it's going to come up at the debate tomorrow night, so we'll see. Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Tracy says, I know a woman who wrote on social media that she was okay with Trump grabbing women by the genitals because he was a billionaire, but she wouldn't want a minimum wage man to do that. It's that not cult-like that I don't know. If that's not cult-like, I don't know what is. Unfortunately, this failure of a human being has women devotees, not just men. Not only has she drunk the Kool-Aid, she's running a whole Kool-Aid stand. Jennifer.
it goes back to what we think or what our concepts are about, class and gender in America, that, any woman, and this is just my opinion, any woman or any man who would be okay with someone grabbing them inappropriately in a sexual assault nature, really, I think, should consider their values, because I think any time, and we teach children to keep your hands to yourself. So, the idea that, if a poor guy did it or a poor person did it to me, I wouldn't be all right. But a rich person would do it. Well, that's fine. That seems it's very problematic to me. That's just me.
Sam, go ahead.
Joe, if I could, it is really cult-like. And, it's a little bit scary because you're sort of starting to see sort of the divine right of kings defense from some folks. The only thing I think we've got going to for us in this whole cult is that Trump is too cheap and fraudulent to actually buy the Kool-Aid. So, I think that's maybe one of the saving parts, but it is a cult.
Acne. But his followers will make the Kool-Aid for him. I mean, that's what's happening. I mean, they're running with it. They're making the Kool-Aid for him. I mean, that's part of the cult problem here, that we are so distorted that it would be okay. So some people think it would be okay in certain situations. And I think part of that is due to the chaos in general. I mean, what has happened in the last 3 years has just been chaos. It's some of it uncontrollable with, coronavirus, but others with the media attacks, with the just all out flip-flopping and back and forth. It is a difficult thing to be able to pinpoint exactly, one solid issue and have it come across and be discussed normally in what's going on with politics right now.
Jill writes to us. We just have about 5 minutes before we go to break. I have a bunch of letters. We're going to try to get to as many as possible. Panel, please interrupt if you would like to have your say as to what the listeners have to say. The thing I really don't understand about McConnell, says Jill, is his disregard for his own people. Isn't Kentucky also hurting? How can McConnell ignore his own financially desperate constituents? Even if he doesn't care about the people, you think he'd want to save his own seat? Or is Kentucky fiscally doing well enough that he doesn't have to be concerned about his seat or his constituents?
Southern state.
I think McConnell. Oops, sorry. Go ahead, Alan.
No, you go ahead, please.
I think McConnell is not worried about his own finances because he has plenty of it. His wife is also doing very
cabinet
well.
Member.
Right. And there was some issues in the past with her divesting her funds that were connected to China, which she didn't quite do properly. So I think he's in it for his own personal control issues.
And while you're on the subject, Jennifer, let's just remember that CNN is reporting this morning that Trump has bank accounts all over the world now that are just being discovered. So thanks for mentioning bank accounts.
Nick writes to us and says it's not necessarily support for Trump. It's support against progressivism and liberalism. Andre says this latest surge is happening around the world. This is regarding COVID at alarming rates, too. Countries in Europe, Belgium, France, Spain. I know that Ireland just shut down. Friends in Switzerland are reporting jumps that are higher than the first surge during the summer.
You know, before you go on, the other letter, I mean, this idea that you are going to vote for somebody who is going to destroy this democracy because you don't like liberalism. I mean, then if you're going to say that, then you might as well just admit that you don't like democracy and you don't like what America stands for.
And think about all those European graves about people who gave their lives to fight for that very democracy. It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
Tyrone writes and says, how can a contested election go on for, and what happens in the interim? It's going to be quite a ride, I would imagine. News that records for 500 children detained at the southern border have been lost, and now there's no easy way to reunite children with their parents. Reminds us that the Trump administration is guilty of crimes against humanity and that Stephen Miller, ex-AG Jeff Sessions in particular, should be prosecuted for such. Also, Trump's support of QAnon and its insane pedophile assertions against Democrats versus the reality of what his own administration has actually perpetrated. We go to Sam, who says, if it's absolutely racism, it is absolutely racism. It's also the inability of a Republican Party to acknowledge the fact that they are part of this cult, and all the people who follow this guy are part of the cult. That's the issue. And yes, racism and white supremacy are a large part of it. We go to Paul. Scary. 100,000 new registrations for Republicans over Democrats in Pennsylvania. Newly registered voter sets are usually highly motivated. Dems need to get out the vote. Barry says, as we all know, a former president received Secret Service protection for a wife. Does that mean that when Trump, lowercase intentional, is convicted and sent to prison, some poor schlubs in the Secret Service will have to be incarcerated too? What a gig.
I thought of that. Right.
Got to work on that. Let's see. Nan says, Nate Silver, 538, gives Biden an 87% chance of winning. Them's great odds. Well, yes, Nan, but they were 92% going into at 6 o'clock on the night of November 8th, 2016. So read what you want into that. Doug says, another factor in understanding Trump's base support is Bonnie and Clyde also enjoyed a large block of the population rooting for them despite the carnage they left behind. There are just some people who enjoy watching a car wreck. Marty says, I'm surprised the panel has not addressed the effect misogyny may have on the election. Biden picked a woman for his running mate in the face of his age and the possibility Kamala might have to step up to the plate. At the very least, it also sets her up for election to the presidency in 4 years. You cannot dismiss the misogynists will withdraw their vote on that account.
Yeah, and at some point, if we talk about the 60 Minute piece, I mean, I think that links directly with what the letter writer is getting to.
And I assume, Jennifer, that would also go with racism.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's see.
I think she's a positive for the ticket, a big positive ticket in terms of getting people out, appropriately, because it signals that this country is not going to be misogynistic and they are going to vote for a woman. And I think it's going to help them, not hurt them.
All right. We'll stop there. We'll take a break. I was going to say we're going to take a vote. Well, we got to wait on that. But we'll take a break now.
A vote yes.
We're voting yes for a break. And then we'll come back and continue with our panel. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Jennifer Burns making up the panel. We go to some letters. Jeff writes, it has been said that McConnell is afraid of passing a $2.2 trillion stimulus before an election that may result in a Democratic majority in the Senate. He wants the blame on Democrats for the deficit for future Republican candidates to use in campaign ads. He's a career politician who looks at the big picture. He's already thinking of 2024 and wants no part of a stimulus that will cause the deficit. We go to PJ, who says Trump must be prosecuted, otherwise others will be encouraged to act in the same manner. Jonathan says the split between moderate centrist Democrats and progressives will be seen as nothing compared to the split between Democrats supporting a Trump prosecution and those supporting Biden if he does not prosecute Trump. That's an interesting point. McConnell, Ricky says, is holding back the deal because he wants protections for businesses. But don't the Republicans want to sue Twitter, Facebook, and others for not allowing hate speech on their platforms?
It's protection for some businesses, not all.
And Suzanne says the long lines to vote are impressive for sure, but does anyone know of any connection between them and reduced number of polling places in predominantly minority neighborhoods? Not a coincidence, I bet.
All right. Yeah, Joe, and that gets back to the whole issue of this, I think, very planned voter suppression effort. And, you know, Alan, I think you hit it right, that, you know, 1% can make a huge difference in this election.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, Jennifer? And it goes back to, too, I mean, we've been talking since the death of John Lewis, right, about where the bill is in the Senate when it comes to the Voting Rights Act. It has gone nowhere, right? And this is on Mitch McConnell's table too. So,
you know, Jennifer, when you think of the Selma Bridge and standing there and getting your head beaten in and all of the rest, you know, that's physical. But what's going on now, the elimination of polling places, repression of voters, it just is insidious. Some people will disagree with me, but, you know, when you're getting your head beaten, and that's terrible, 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 no question about it. But it's to the same end.
It is to the same end, and it's systemic racism in the federal government. This is voter suppression. You know, we think about the civil rights movement, it was state-level policies, right? And everybody blamed those southern states for, you know, their suppression. Well, this is now happening in the federal government. The federal government is doing it nationwide and targeting minority communities. That's what it is.
I would like to move on to the some other topics here, and I do want to talk about the 60 Minutes story that Trump is now going after Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes. The president abruptly cut off an interview with 60 Minutes star Leslie Stahl at the White House on Tuesday, and then taunted her on Twitter, posting a short behind-the-scenes video of her at the taping and noting that she had not been wearing a mask in the clip. Mr. Trump then threatened to post his interview with Ms. Stahl ahead of its intended broadcast time on Sunday evening, calling it fake and biased. The spectacle of a president 2 weeks from Election Day picking a fight with the nation's most popular television news program began on Tuesday after Mr. Trump grew irritated with Ms. Stahl's questions, according to two people familiar with the circumstances. One person briefed on what took place said that Mr. Trump had spent more than 45 minutes filming with Leslie Stahl and her CBS News crew, and that the taping had not wrapped up when the president's aides had expected it to. So Mr. Trump cut the interview short and then declined to participate in a walk-and-talk segment with Ms. Stahl and Vice President Mike Pence. It appeared that Ms. Stahl's approach did not sit well with the president. Hours later, Trump said on Twitter that he was considering posting the interview with Ms. Stahl prior to airtime, shouty caps from the president on Twitter. He described it as a terrible electoral intrusion and suggested that his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden, had been treated less harshly by journalistic interlocutors.
What exactly did he think was going to happen in that interview? He thought that it was going to be nicey-nicey? No, he knew what was going to happen. And walking out is consistent with his behavior. And of course, the idea of posting it himself could only hurt him even more because more people would see it that way.
Bob?
Alan, I'm in complete agreement. This is just orchestrated outrage. I mean, the only thing more that Trump could have done would be to bring a folding chair and hit her across the head like he used to do at the WWE. This is so false. This threat of releasing it is trying to get ahead of bad news. I'm sure he probably butchered the interview like he does all interviews. Talk about some crap. This is just manufactured outrage, intended to try to get people to feel sympathy for him. Remember that pathetic cry out to suburban women, you know, oh, why don't you like me? You know, it's not going to help him.
Well, I think it's a little bit of a hit back, too, after the Fauci interview that came out in 60 Minutes.
Yes.
Oh, good point.
I mean,
according to the Washington Post, though, according to some of the anonymous quotes in the Washington Post, it really wasn't that bad of an interview. At least it wasn't that much worse than a lot of the interviews Trump has done recently. It's not exactly clear why he has reacted so strongly. If you're being cynical about it, you could say, well, you know, by drawing so much attention to this interview, he's making sure a lot more people watch it. So maybe it didn't go that bad. Maybe he thinks it went better for him than he's letting on. But, you know, he's running against the media. It's an effective strategy. Running against the press and shows like 60 Minutes is a very good way to rile up his base.
But especially women in the media.
Women, for sure.
I mean, the last week has been Kristen Welker. The last week has been, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that goes all the way back to the Megyn Kelly questions. You know, I don't know if that was even might have early 2016, right?
Right.
You know, even maybe
2015. Yeah.
But you know, there has been a lot of outrage among his voters that the question, you know, that the town halls and the various questions that Biden participates in have been essentially love fests, you know, and the ones that Trump participates in have been very hostile. So I think, you know, he's kind of tapping into that frustration. And I think it, you know, in some ways it's probably a pretty successful strategy
strategy. We'll see in a couple of Tuesdays.
You know, I have a question I've been wondering about, you know, and that is, what do Trump voters want the questions to be? Right. They're
that's
right.
A good, like, great what, point. What, yeah.
That. So I've been struggling with that lately. What is it that you want asked of him that I don't know, you think he'll answer great or you want to hear him talk about? Because that, I think, would be very telling about why his base is attracted to him, what their interests are.
Yeah. I mean, the people I've talked to aren't necessarily so upset about the questions he's being asked or the grilling that he's getting. They're just wondering why Biden isn't getting tough questions on the other side, which I think is a valid point.
Give us a few. If you think it's a valid point, give us a couple that you would think he should be asked.
That Biden should be asked about?
Yeah. I mean, how many times can you say Hunter Biden?
We talked about it earlier. The idea of not saying whether or not you intend to pack the court, I think that's a pretty important thing to press him on, right? I'm not even sure that's, you know, did that come up within the Stephanopoulos interview? I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of people would like him to ask about the New York Post stories, and I understand why, you know, journalists are hesitant to do that, but it does seem like they could say, you know, Mr. Biden, what's your reaction to this reporting in the New York Post?
Of course, it's a phony story. That's why.
I don't know. There's a gazillion questions they could ask him. But I think it's more the whole tenor of the interviews. It's not just the particular questions. It's just, you know, if you watch those two town halls last week, you know, it's clear that Trump was treated much more aggressively than Biden was.
Oh, I just think, Chris.
You know,
justified.
Biden
Biden
has not been pressed enough.
I'm very proud that Chris is on the show, really.
Well, I'm proud too,
because he's the other side, you know. I mean, you know, he's wrong, but it's great to have him.
if you go in and saying you're grieved and you're, you know, the world is against you and everything you say, and that's how you show up. Why wouldn't it be hostile? It's obviously going to be more hostile. If you go in and you say, ask me a question and I will give you a logical, well-thought-out answer, that tenor is going to be different.
And I think if the press could be criticized, I think if the press could be criticized for anything, it's for always Trump, and say, oh, yes, you can see them scratching their heads and saying, oh, yeah, we better get something from Biden. And then they put Biden on for 1 second, but then they go back to Trump because he's so outrageous, and he really does attract all those eyeballs.
I mean, Biden got some really tough questions at the town hall with George Stephanopoulos, from Stephanopoulos himself, but as well as from the audience. But he answered them, but just the tenor of it was different. I'm not saying that the quality of the answers, but as far as the tone, when you say that they're confrontational, but Trump comes in, as you said, it's a war on the media. So he comes in ready for a fight, and that obviously is a strategy. So I don't know how you change your strategy with the other candidate when one has decided to play that game.
Yeah, you can't blame Joe Biden for turning blue in the face when Trump pulls all the oxygen out of the room. I mean, this is his own making. This is this is a reflection of his lies. It's his reflection on how he has mismanaged the office. It's also what happens when you're the incumbent and you own all of the bad things and all of the good things that happen. I mean, so I think it's been relatively fair.
I'm not a big. While there's a moment of silence, I would just say I'm not a big George Stephanopoulos fan. Period. Explanation point.
All right.
I mean, just to be clear, I am perfectly fine with Trump being grilled as much as he's being grilled. He has a poor record of 4 years as president, and he should be asked tough questions about that. But I do think that as a member of the press, I have been a little bit worried at how little Biden has been pressed on various things. I just think it sets a bad standard. I can't remember any presidential candidate in my lifetime ever going through this process with such an easy path. I mean, I know that that's largely because of Trump, and Trump, either demands or gets almost all the attention and almost all the oxygen. That's been true since 2015. But I do think that reporters should be pressing Biden a little bit more.
Well, maybe it has something to do with it.
I agree, but I think part of it is because Biden, is consistent in his answers. It's like a real conversation. Whereas with Trump, it's hard because he's inconsistent with his answers and he throws different things out every other day. So it encourages people to ask deeper to try to get at the real answer. So it's that, I think. I mean, with Biden, he says what he says, you think about it, and you listen. With Trump, it's difficult because you're like, wait, yesterday, didn't you say this? And then in 2 hours, you tweet something else. So what is the story? Mm. And so I think that feeds into why it seems so drilling on Trump.
And couldn't it have something to do with the fact that the United States is now facing, a revision in its norm so that we stop being democratic and start being fascistic and totalitarian? I'm sorry, Chris, to have to speak this way, but, I don't think there's ever been a time in the history of this country that we have faced a worse possibility. And if the press is pressing the would-be totalitarian more, that's good.
Yeah, but I mean, you're taking a side there, right? And that's an opinion. And
I am.
And a lot of people
hold that opinion.
But I don't know that it's the press corps.
No, it's fact. It's not opinion.
Well, a lot of people would disagree with you, I guess. But I'm not sure that it's the press corps. I mean, the press does have an obligation to play it somewhat fair. I take your point that there's a lot to question Trump on. But again, Biden should be questioned more aggressively than he's being questioned. I mean, and partly it's not entirely the press's fault. Biden has made very few public appearances. He doesn't take a lot of questions. So it's, you know, it's
what do we?
If you don't have access to the guy, you can't ask him tough questions.
Okay, but he's done how many town halls? He's done how many? I don't know. I still go back to the tenor of it. I mean, it's because it's not a circus. It doesn't make as much of a fuss. I mean, we're not talking about Joe Biden's interview with 60 Minutes because he didn't get up and walk out and tweet about it.
He's leading by 9 or 10 points right nationally. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Why would you change your strategy?
He's playing it safe. He's playing it safe, and that's a good strategy. I don't disagree with you. I mean, yeah, when you're ahead in the polls, you don't have to. You can play it safe, but that doesn't
mean so much is at stake.
He shouldn't be asked tough questions when people get a chance.
And so much is at stake. And by the way, I've heard him ask tough questions. He answers them. He may be a little bit on the boring side, but he answers them.
Well, and think about, just over the weekend, Senator John Thune, right, had said Trump needs to kind of stop. He needs to play it safe. Stop running off at the mouth. Stop with the Twitter. Stop with the, engaging and the distractions and the throwing stuff out there. And all weekend, Trump continued to do it, right? And into this week, he continued to do it. And so I think that's the other reason it becomes problematic, because it heightens this divide people are watching in the Republican Party. People are searching to get just those answers and something consistent from Trump. And what they're not liking is that the consistency is chaos.
Mm.
Right? And I mean, that's really it. They don't want to accept that that's it. And I think you can tell the difference, too, here when you're looking at, how the vice presidential debate, right? Pence has tremendous, he's more like a Biden in how he answers questions. Right. There's that decorum. So he can be pressed just like Kamala can be pressed. But the delivery of their answers remains consistent. Right. They can still go back and forth at each other a little bit. But there's still a decorum there that is not present in any of these interviews with Donald Trump. There's always the wait to see if he marches out or he tries to control it or he tries to switch it or he calls names or, and I think that's part of the problem, a major problem with why it seems like he's getting so overly attacked in his interviews.
Well, the real question is he going to win? It's not that he's attacked. It's not that he's right or wrong in what he's doing, but he thinks that this is the way he won the last time, and this is the way that he's going to win this time. And this panel gave it to me earlier in the discussion and made it clear that, there was some tightening going on, and that's with his behaving the way that he is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think we might have overstated the case a little bit earlier. Like, I mean, Biden is still the overwhelming favorite to win. Well, no, I mean, people should be aware that there is a path for Trump to win in the Electoral College. But, Hillary Clinton never had this big of a lead. Or if she did, it was always in flux, right? I mean, Biden is in good shape. Nobody should discount that.
But
and,
I do
you know,
think...
To go back to what Jennifer was saying, one of the interesting things about 2016, the way it all played out, was that after the Access Hollywood tape, in a weird way, Trump kind of went into not hiding exactly, but he was much more subdued for the weeks leading up to the election. He stopped a lot of the wild tweeting and the wild accusations. He started for some reason listening to his advisors a little bit more and having a little bit more message discipline. And a lot of people think that's why he was able to eke out a victory.
Bob,
and he's not doing any of that now. Jennifer is exactly right that he is just, every day causing a new stir that takes him off message. And this 60 Minutes interview is kind of a perfect example of that.
Bob, you've been eerily quiet.
No, I think it's a fascinating conversation. And I'll go back to something that I readily admit to, that I do have PTSD from 2016. So I think you're right about the numbers, Chris. I also am very suspect that there's something else going on that I don't know.
Like
I do
Trump
think
cheating.
That
yeah.
Like what?
Yeah.
Like Trump cheating. In other words, if you're going to try to rob this election, that's the something else that Bob is referring to. We don't know how far he's going to go. I think this guy has no bottom.
Well, and also, I agree with you. Also, to Chris's point that he made earlier, you know, if you look at the Electoral College, right now Trump is running ahead of where he was in the 2016 polls, and he won in 2016.
Yeah, I mean,
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah. I mean, the alarming thing about it is that if he did win in the Electoral College, he would lose, almost certainly lose the popular vote by a much larger margin than he did last time.
Right.
And to have that happen, I mean, what that would mean for people's perception of the country and a democracy would be bad.
Yes, and I think Hillary.
Does he really care about that, though, Chris? I mean, if you think about it, all he cares about is, you know, his base.
I don't think he should. I mean, if he wins the Electoral College, he wins the Electoral College. That's the system we have. But I think a lot of people would lose faith in the system if he lost the popular vote by, you know, 6-7 million votes and still became the president. And you know, the one point that one of the readers made earlier that I thought was something to keep an eye on.
We have listeners. It's fine.
But those registration numbers are something to keep an eye on, or at least think about, because in a number of states there have been big Republican registration gains, and it is possible that those people, because they're not regular voters, are not being captured in some of the polls.
Yep.
And also to Alan's point about the stealing aspect, it is it's easier to steal when you have a difference of, I mean, some of these poll numbers in certain states, if these numbers are even somewhat accurate, of 0.3, 0.8, 1%, 1.3%, it's easier then to make the argument when it's that close and you've got so many ballots that are out where every ballot is going to count.
And you have a Republican governor in Florida and a Republican secretary of state.
Right.
And you have accusations of robbery, first degree, going on in past elections in Florida. You can see what the potential problems are.
Yeah. And you don't have – it's easier to steal when you own the Department of Justice as well. And let me put this on the table. This is the first – and you're going to hear this for the first time here. If Trump wins, the first thing he's going to try to do is to change the Constitution to run for a third term. And if that happens, I'm supporting Obama.
All right.
Roselle and I have already made our reservations in Ireland.
You can't go there. They're shut down.
We're going to swim there.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue, and we will continue our conversation with our wonderful panel. Last chance to get your letters in, panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Last call. Are you chuckling, Bob? Is that you chuckling at the music?
It's just not getting any better for me, Joe. I try. I just can't.
I feel so bad because Mike and Sarah work so hard on the music, and so I feel bad when we make fun of it, because it's not making fun of them. Obviously, it's just, I don't know. It's something to do, and I apologize. Yeah, they are amazing, and it may be a symphony to somebody else. Who knows? All right. We go to a couple notes. First of all, the governor of New York State, Andrew Cuomo, will be addressing the state, will be giving an update on the coronavirus efforts here in the Empire State, and will be speaking at 11:30 from the Red Room in Albany. We'll be going to that live as soon as it happens. Also, the other big story that has come out, which is really something, is that that Pope Francis has endorsed same-sex civil unions for the first time as a Pope while being interviewed for a feature-length documentary, saying homosexual people have the right to be in a family. They are children of God. So let it be noted that the Catholic Church is more progressive than most of the Republican Party.
It'd be interesting to see what the new justice is going to do with that.
I was going to say that too.
Interesting. So we'll figure. We'll keep an eye on that. The film had its premiere at the Rome Film Festival earlier today. Let's talk about Chuck Schumer for a minute, shall we? I think the story is interesting. So there was a big kerfuffle because there are not enough things in Washington to be kerfuffled about. The way that Dianne Feinstein on the Judiciary Committee reacted at the end by hugging Lindsey Graham apparently was way off the mark. And Schumer says he had a serious talk with Feinstein. And the reason is some liberal groups criticized her handling of last week's Supreme Court confirmation hearings and requested that she step aside as the top Democrat. Schumer, who has also faced doubts about his strategic moves from the most liberal activists, declined to say what steps he would take, but acknowledged the problem had prompted a discussion about Feinstein holding such an important post. I've had a long and serious talk with the senator. That's all I'm going to say about it right now, Schumer told reporters at his news conference. Feinstein is the oldest senator, 87 years old, would be poised to chair the committee should Democrats win the majority in November's election, putting her in charge of shepherding the potential Biden administration's most critical nominees to the Justice Department and federal courts. The Senate panel also has jurisdiction over immigration legislation, gun laws, and other hot-button issues. Asked by reporters about Schumer's comments, Feinstein lifted her hand to signal she wouldn't answer. Please, thank you, she said, declining to comment. What do you think? Oh, I just wanted to say that the part of the issue was at the end of the hearing on Thursday, last Thursday, she credited Republicans for holding a hearing with decorum and even hugged Lindsey Graham, the chair who had previously pledged to never consider a Supreme Court nominee in an election year. Graham is locked in a competitive Senate race, of course, with Jamie Harrison. Okay, Alan.
Ugh. I mean, you know, you want to be defensive about her. I have been in the past because when people have raised issues about her age, I'm sort of sensitive about that issue. But I have to tell you that this was not good. And, you know, this is highly visual. And I do not believe that Chuck is wearing a hairpiece, which is the question I get most of the time. But I do believe it was awful, and it was a bad judgment. Whether she was 20 years old or in her 80s, it's just not good. It was not good, and I think the leader has to be very careful about something like that. And there have been changes in committee chairmanships on both sides, and I think it would be appropriate.
Is it possible? I think you, and you just said it, Alan, and I agree with you. But it seems like there should be an extraction. I mean, the case of her hugging Lindsey Graham and saying the decorum. I mean, I understand people being bitter about that. But the same token, I mean, I think that's something where she is very proper. She believes in the institution of the Senate, and these people that she's worked with forever. So I don't know. Maybe that's, you can give her a pass on that. But then the other question is, yeah, if she is to become chairman, is that a question that you can have a good sit down and say, look, for the good of everyone, maybe it's time for some younger blood in to come and to work through this difficult process given these fractured times?
Yeah, and Joe, I agree with you. I don't have a problem.
Go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead. I was about to pull a Churchill. I was going to say, I thought the fact that any senators are showing civility in this day and age is something that we should support. I didn't see a problem with what she did with Graham.
I'd like to see more hugging.
The question.
I mean, yeah, not in COVID, but yes.
Because it's okay to disagree. You know, this is the thing. It's okay to disagree. It's not okay to be uncivil the way we've become. Now, the question of her capacity to continue on, if she's going to be ranking member of the committee and chair, I think that's actually legitimate. And that's where I certainly urge Schumer to consider his position really carefully, because it's going to be an incredibly important position for the Biden administration.
But not because of her age. In other words, it would be appropriate to replace her if you felt she wasn't up to the job, right? And Joe, as far as I'm concerned, when you mentioned extraction, I reached for my tooth.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Interesting word.
Well, it's just that you have these things that are intertwined that I think one, you know, gets wrapped into the other. And I think they should be brought aside, because I agree with Bob. I mean, I think having decorum and having, of people... look, it wasn't as, you know, one of the things you can say about that hearing is, we certainly can have our feelings about the justice, but one thing you can say about that hearing is it wasn't as awful and divisive as the Kavanaugh hearing. And I don't know.
And that's because the Democrats didn't have a shot. That's why it wasn't.
Yeah. No, you're right.
They did not have a shot of stopping her.
You're right. I don't know if decorum is such a horrible thing, but. For whatever, Chris.
You know, I thought Schumer's comment was a little bit condescending. I mean, he sounded as if he had just had a conversation with a child, and to me it was a little bit insulting. I mean, Dianne Feinstein, say whatever you want about her, but she's had a long and distinguished career. She's been a trailblazer. Yes, she's getting up there in age, but I don't know. It was just that there's a little bit of a hint of. I don't want to say it was sexism exactly, although maybe it was, but I just there was something in Schumer's tone that just kind of struck me the wrong way.
I agree with Chris on that. I all the headlines and how he had this talk, like he set her straight.
Yeah.
I found that part pretty offensive, for sure. And for me, I think the problem in this situation here is not really the decorum, because that was refreshing. I mean, we're comparing this to this totally dysfunctional way of screaming at each other and name calling. I mean, right? So it's really bottom level here we're comparing to. So it was refreshing to have something be orderly in a certain sense.
Now let me be clear. I love you all, but I disagree with you. The fact is that we are in a fight for democracy versus totalitarianism, as far as I'm concerned here. And the Republicans are trying to put that nail in the coffin. So, Chuck Schumer, by the way, is I talk to him, and I've interviewed him a number of times. And I have to tell you, I don't think he's in a tough spot, because most Democrats, or a lot of Democrats, are yelling, "You're not tough enough, Chuck. You're the leader of the party, and you're not doing enough."
But you just
and you should wait. And you should be irate, and you're not irate. And now when he's irate, everybody's a little pejorative, a little this, a little sexist. I think he's got to do what he's got to do.
Yeah, but as you said, they had a chance with Kavanaugh. They didn't have a chance here. So what right. What exactly did Feinstein do wrong in her Democratic leadership on that committee?
A great deal, I think.
I would say, regardless of that part, the separate part that I had issues with was her questioning of Barrett. It was very filled with sort of a motherly praise and like sympathy for her position. It was almost like a...
How do you take care of all those kids?
Yeah, I mean, it was... That part is where I have the biggest problem. Showing some respect to your colleagues who you disagree with, I commend that.
Yeah.
But the way that she interviewed, I found to be, or the way she was questioning her and talking to her, I found to be very problematic. That part turned me right off, more than the hug of Graham and all of that. So that part made me question if she would be able to take on this chair if it should happen.
I want to take the last 5 minutes out of our conversation to get ready for tomorrow night. Trump and Biden are getting ready for the final debate of a very bitter campaign. It is the final televised face-off. It seems like it's going to happen, that this is, as of right now, it seems like it's going to happen. And both camps are getting ready. The Biden team has pretty much, the vice president has... not participated in any events because he is hunkering down and getting ready for the debate. The president even said that he perhaps would change his election, his debate strategy, which I think is generous considering that I guess what he did before was a strategy. But part of that strategy is also to eviscerate the moderator, who will be NBC's Kristen Welker. So with that, what do we make of the debate to take place in Nashville just 12 days before Election Day?
Well, we know that Biden is on the defensive. He has to be because he's in the lead. If he blows it, that would be a terrible thing for him. So the fact that he's taken 2 days to prepare for it, you know, indicates what are the zingers going to be? What are the one-liners, for example? Will you shut up? You remember that?
Right,
one?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, he's used that once already. So what does he do? And I'm sure...
that one will work again.
Yeah. You can probably polish that off and use it again, I would think.
In fact, Chris, maybe he'll say, once again, will you shut up? That's right. But then you can be sure... That's what they're dealing with, you know. I knew Jack Kennedy, and you're not him.
Right.
And you're no Jack Kennedy. Those are the things that people will remember out of a debate.
Well, the mics are going to be muted this time, too,
No, only in that one situation after the first 2 minutes. Otherwise, the mics, I don't believe, are going to be muted.
That's right, just for the two-minute. The two-minute statements will be uninterrupted.
Right. But that's kind of weird to me because, I mean, won't you be able to, if somebody's interrupting somebody, won't you still be able to hear them?
Yes.
I mean, the mics are going to pick it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, they're not in the same room.
Are they? What do you mean?
Are they in the same room?
Oh, I think they're in the same room.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're in the same room.
I think that also does a disservice here because if you mute the mics, but say, we'll just go reverse, Biden's interrupting Trump and it throws off his answers, right? Then we don't have the ability to fully understand why this other candidate is answering the way that they are, like why they're in, you know, what's going on. And so I think that's part of the problem. I mean, there's nothing, in my opinion, that's bad. You get 2 minutes to speak and then you talk. Great. But if you can hear it through the mics or if it's distracting for a candidate to answer the questions because of what someone's doing under their breath or over there in the corner, it's gonna, you know, we're gonna have a view of that candidate, like why can't they answer these questions, and not really understand what else is going on if we don't hear it.
So although I think you're missing the opportunity for some great humor. I mean, imagine Trump's lips moving and no words coming out. It'd be like watching the 1960s and 70s kung fu movies, and think about our ability to then go back and put words there. Joe, I'm shocked. I'm actually shocked that they're even having it. I am too. I'm still not convinced that it's not going to get pulled out at the last minute because of
by whom?
You know, by Trump.
Well, or Trump. Just because of the if somebody fails a test or something. I mean, that is possible. I don't know, but it is possible. We're out of time. We have to go. But my thanks to everybody. You're all wonderful. Alan Chartok, thank you very much. Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Jennifer Burns, thank you for your wonderful input. We'll be back. And a reminder, the governor at 11:30.